Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News. It's 5 p.m. You're listening to Breakthrough News, and this is The Punch Out. We're following the news all day so you don't have to, giving you everything you need to know about what's in the headlines and what should be. And yes, we are back here on The Punch Out. First of September 2021. Happy September to you. Very happy to be here with you on the show. Plenty for you here on the show, as we always do. We're going to be talking about a much belated exoneration that makes right an egregious wrong. We're going to be talking also about the massive extinction risk facing the world's trees. Yep, it's not just animals anymore. But before we get to either of those two very important stories, we're going to be talking about how the state of Alabama is holding an innocent man on death row. DeForest Johnson, sentenced to death in Alabama in 1998 for allegedly committing a murder in Birmingham, is clearly innocent, but still on death row, despite clear and obvious evidence that he did not do it. And recently, his attempts to be freed from the death house have gained a little bit of wind in the sails, as three of the jurors who convicted him came out last week and stated that they were wrong. And had they been presented with the evidence that they were denied then, they never would have voted to convict him. Monique Hicks, one of those jurors, stated, quote, "I think we convicted an innocent man." Johnson was charged alongside Ardragus Ford with the murder of Deputy Sheriff William G. Hardy. Now, the first indication that something was wrong with Johnson's conviction is that Ford, who was tried separately, was actually acquitted of the murder. For Johnson, however, the entire case has just been a travesty of justice and clear misconduct by police and prosecutors. There was no physical evidence connecting either man to the crime. 10 alibi witnesses placed them at a nightclub on the other side of town at the time of the murder. And in fact, there is even records of Ford making a phone call somewhere else at the time of the murder. Ford and Johnson were later pulled over with two teenage girls, allegedly because they were driving some sort of suspicious vehicle, although that vehicle did not match the description of the vehicle at the scene of the crime. Police immediately pressured the girls to testify that they had witnessed the murder and threatened them with jail for lying. One of the girls refused to lie and was, in fact, put in jail. The other, 15-year-old at the time, Yolanda Chambers, succumbed to the pressure and lied. As she later stated when asked why she had lied, quote, "Because the pressure. They was telling me, you know, don't you know you can go to jail for this? And that's all I was thinking. That's all I had put in my mind. Jail. I don't want to go. So after they was putting all the pressure on me, I went on and said I was there. Maybe if I go on and say I was there, maybe all the threats and everything will end." Asked why she accused Ford and Johnson specifically, she said, quote, "Because I mean, that's what they wanted to hear, that Ardragus was the one who killed the police officer," end quote. At Johnson's trial, the prosecution presented a new witness, Violet Ellison, a friend of the slain deputy, who came forward the day after a $10,000 reward was announced for information and claimed she overheard Johnson admit to the crime while eavesdropping on a prison phone call. Prosecutors and the trial judge did not reveal the fact that she came forward specifically for the reward money. This came out later. And it's also worth noting that the trial judge had a brother who is a sheriff's deputy in the same department as the slain officer. Over the course of several appeals for both men, the prosecution presented five different theories of the crime, at one point arguing in parallel trials that they both pulled the trigger. Ford was ultimately acquitted because of better legal representation that raised many of the troublesome issues you've heard so far. Johnson's attorney, of course, neglected most of them, and Johnson was convicted and sentenced to death. But the issue is pretty clear-cut. The cops went looking for someone to pin the murder on, found two men, manufactured two cases, and convicted one. The duplicity is so clear that, as the Death Penalty Information Center relates, quote, "Johnson has received support for a new trial from more than a dozen former Alabama prosecutors, judges, and state bar presidents, as well as Jefferson County District Attorney Danny Carr. former Alabama Attorney General Bill Baxley, a self-described lifelong defender of the death penalty, is among those calling to overturn Johnson's conviction. "The guy is not guilty," Baxley said. "The guy is innocent." Johnson's case is sadly not rare. The National Registry of Exonerations has studied the issue of misconduct and exonerations and found that since 1989, quote, "misconduct was present in more than half of all exonerations in nearly three quarters of death penalty cases, and misconduct tended to increase in frequency as the crime's charges became more severe." The registry found misconduct in 54% of all exonerations, rising to 72% in cases which exonerees had been sentenced to death. Well, we can certainly say that hopefully Johnson will prevail. And if not, it's 100% clear Alabama will be executing an innocent person. Well, unfortunately, I've got more bad news as it regards the state of the planet. A new comprehensive study of trees around the globe has found that, quote, "between a third and half of the world's wild tree species are threatened with extinction, posing a risk of wider ecosystem collapse." As the Guardian newspaper lays out, quote, "Forest clearance for farming is by far the biggest cause of the die-off, according to the State of the World Trees report, which was released on Wednesday, along with a call for urgent action to reverse the decline. The five-year international study found 17,510 species of trees are threatened, which is twice the number of threatened mammals, birds, amphibians, and reptiles combined. This was 29.9% of the 58,497 known species of trees in the world. But the proportion at risk is likely to be higher, as a further 7.1% were deemed possibly threatened, 21.6% were insufficiently evaluated, and only 41.5% were confirmed as safe. This is obviously a very serious issue, as The Guardian further details, quote, "Botanists describe trees as the backbone of the natural ecosystem. Although only 0.2% of species have become extinct so far, the authors say an accelerating decline could have dire knock-on effects. Humans are directly affected by the loss of carbon sequestration, oxygen production, timber for construction, fuel for fires, ingredients for medicines and foods, buffers from storms, and the well-being that comes from shade and beauty. Arguably more important are the indirect impacts on natural life support systems. In many parts of the world, trees are the pillars of a healthy ecosystem. Without them, other plants, insects, birds, and mammals struggle to survive. Trees are essential. It's like a Jenga tower. Pull the wrong one out, and the ecosystem falls apart," said the report's lead author, Malin Rivers. The report says that the main threats to trees are farming at the top place, crop farming being 29%, livestock farming being 14%. In terms of their contribution to the cause of trees going extinct, logging, 27%, housing and other commercial development, 13%, fire, 13%, mining, 9%, pulp plantation, 6%, and invasive species, 3%. The report's author suggests an expansion of protected area coverage for threatened species, planting campaigns that focus on the highest risk populations, closer global collaboration, more funding for conservation efforts, and greater efforts to back up species in botanic gardens and seed banks as a way to address this crisis. So the cause is not totally hopeless, but this has to be seen as yet another red flag about the precarious state of the planet. Well, in decades-old death penalty news, yesterday, Ralph Northam, governor of Virginia, offered a posthumous pardon to the Martinsville Seven. Seven black men falsely accused, fraudulently convicted, and unjustly executed for the rape of a white woman in Virginia in 1951. At the time, the case symbolized the narrowing of democratic space in the United States during the rise of the Cold War, and of course, the ongoing issue of white supremacy in the country. The case had many echoes of the famous Scottsboro case in the 1930s, including the energetic involvement of communists at the core of the defense campaign. Ruby Floyd, a 32-year-old white woman, entered the black part of Martinsville in January of 1949. She'd been known for distributing Jehovah's Witness literature in the area before, in defiance of strict Jim Crow racial norms, and was on her way to collect money for some clothes she had sold to someone in the broader neighborhood. Ultimately, something took place, the police were called, and she said she had been raped by several black men. The police quickly arrested two men and over the next few days arrested five more. In all the cases, the defendants were held incommunicado, pressured to sign confessions, and in some cases they were so drunk they didn't even know what was going on. The authorities went the usual route, convened all-white Jim Crow juries in Martinsville, where there was no chance of a fair trial after a massive amount of racist publicity surrounding the trial, and the seven were promptly convicted. The case had all the hallmarks of injustice and drew a huge amount of protests around the country, organized primarily by the Civil Rights Congress. The CRC was a civil rights group with many communists at the center, similar to the National Negro Congress of the 1930s that had been a leading, broad front civil rights organization. However, because of the rise of Cold War tensions, the CRC was viciously attacked by the ruling elites of the United States. So despite organizing very energetically, they faced serious headwinds, making the campaign get to the levels that it would need to really affect the politics of the case. The NAACP tried to edge out the communists and also discourage public campaigning, period, in support of the Seven. And with the Korean War having just broken out, solidifying the consensus to move towards a Cold War, mass civil rights activity in general was quickly branded communist. The very idea of organizing protests, demonstrations, letter-writing campaigns, and especially international solidarity, regardless of the ideological content of any of this, was deemed communistic. Further, the rush towards the Cold War required a strengthening of the domestic anti-communist political wing of the establishment, if you will, which meant accommodating the Dixiecrats of the Jim Crow South, the most hardcore anti-communist and the most militarist subset of the American domestic political establishment. And this meant the type of northern liberal and labor support that had begun to coalesce, at least loosely, around expanded civil rights for blacks was not forthcoming, as the leaders of many unions and liberal organizations were both A, afraid of being tainted by the association with communists, and B, wanting to keep the Democratic Party coalition together and did not want to offend the Jim Crow Democrats by raising an outcry. So the Seven ended up going to their deaths after some appeals, and without a doubt, their trials were unfair, but the issue of their so-called guilt has never been fully litigated. Like with cases of this kind, the Martinsville Seven case could not be allowed to look into the facts. The outlines of it, again like many cases like it, touch on the then third rail issue of white-black sexual relations. Rumors have trickled down through the years that Floyd was in a consensual relationship with one of the Seven. At the time, it was very usual for white women to falsely accuse black men of rape and concoct all sorts of stories to cover up the social shame of having had some sort of consensual relationship with a black man. In a fairly cowardly move, Governor Northam refused to opine on this issue in the innocence of the Martinsville Seven, focusing only on their trial being unfair. Some may say too little too late, and of course they were executed, but for the purposes of history, this is important, and it is right. The Martinsville Seven did not deserve to be executed, and they deserve to have the historical record reflect the deep injustice that was done to them. That's the punch out for today. We're with you Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. here in New York, East Coast Standard Time, 2 p.m. in Los Angeles, Pacific Standard Time, and 9 p.m. GMT. And of course, you can support everything we do here at Breakthrough News at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. It's your patronage that keeps all of our offerings here at Breakthrough News moving forward. And of course, you can check us out across all your social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at BT Newsroom.